This country is at war with Germany.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaela Höfner. In diesem Podcast spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, mit US-Veteranen, mit Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, die Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg. Ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. Bevor es heute losgeht, muss ich noch eine traurige Nachricht mit euch teilen. Kurt Salterberg, mein Interviewgast von Folge 22, der letzte Zeuge, ist am 27. November 23 im Alter von 100 Jahren friedlich bei sich zu Hause eingeschlafen. Nicht einmal im ganz hohen Alter hat ihn sein phänomenales Gedächtnis verlassen. Bitte behaltet stets im Hinterkopf, dass es sich im Podcast um Gäste im hohen bis sehr hohen Alter handelt. Deshalb ist es umso wichtiger, die Geschichten und Erzählungen einzufangen und weiterzugeben. An dieser Stelle danke ich euch nochmal fürs Einschalten, fürs Zuhören und Weitererzählen. Oktober 1938, New York. Meine Hände umschließen die kalte Reling und die Seeluft bläst mir ins Gesicht. Weht mir fast die Mütze vom Kopf. Die Tränen meiner Mutter sind wieder frisch. Über die Wochen auf See sind sie kaum getrocknet. Wie bitterlich haben wir doch geweint, als wir unsere Heimat verlassen mussten. Jetzt aber werden wir Vater wiedersehen. Seemöwen kreisen neugierig über uns. Die Schiffssirene brummt so laut, dass sie durch meinen ganzen Körper vibriert. Das Schiff schiebt sich wie ein Pflug durch die Wellen. Ich bin froh, nach der wochenlangen Fahrt endlich wieder festen Boden unter den Füßen zu haben. Einige Male hatten wir Sturm und meterhohe Wellen. Ich bin definitiv nicht für die See geboren. Salz legt sich auf meine Lippen, als ich mit der Zunge darüber fahre. Das fremde Land ist eine dunkle Linie am Horizont. Ich kneife die Augen zusammen und schärfe sie, bis ich die Fackel der Freiheitsstatue erkenne. Mutter hat mir von ihr erzählt. Doch je näher wir kommen, desto gewaltiger wird sie. Die Zacken der Krone ragen in den schiefergrauen Himmel. Gänsehaut überzieht meine Arme und Beine. Miss Liberty, so wird sie von den Amerikanern genannt. Noch nie habe ich ein solches Bauwerk mit eigenen Augen gesehen. Stärke, Widerstandskraft, Freiheit. Vielleicht haben wir sie ja hier gefunden. Ich habe aber die Frauen an Bord miteinander wispern hören, als sie dachten, dass wir Kinder schlafen. Ob die Amerikaner uns überhaupt von Bord gehen lassen? Zahlreiche Schiffe wurden mit voller Besetzung zurückgeschickt. Uns Juden will keiner haben, hat Mutter unter Tränen gesagt. Aber Vater ist doch hier drüben. Er wird alles richten. Er wird dafür sorgen, dass wir hier in Sicherheit sind. Keiner kann sich vorstellen, wie es für uns Juden ist, in Deutschland zu leben. Die schöne Heimat ist zum Feind geworden. Hasserfüllt und tödlich. Plötzlich muss ich an meinen Onkel Max denken. Die Nazis haben ihn erwischt und brutal zusammengeschlagen. Ob er wohl über uns wacht und dafür sorgt, dass wir entkommen können? Die goldene Fackel kratzt am Himmel die Wolken zur Seite. Von ihrer Krone stehen majestätisch die 7 Zacken ab. Ich biege meinen Kopf in den Nacken, je näher wir der Freiheitsstatue kommen. Mama, Sie können uns doch nicht einfach wieder heimschicken, oder? Richte ich das Wort nun an meine Mutter. Ich denke nicht. Ich spüre die Verunsicherung in ihrer Stimme. Nein, es kann doch nicht sein, dass die Amerikaner uns wieder zurückschicken. Zurück zu allen Hänseleien, den Demütigungen, der Verfolgung. Papa habe ich jetzt schon Monate nicht gesehen, seit die Gestapo zu uns nach Hause gekommen ist und nach ihm gesucht hat. Mutter hat ihm aber eine Warnung geschickt. Jetzt sind wir selbst auf der Flucht. Franz, Franz! Ein Mann rennt aufgekratzt an der Anliegestelle herum. Er hat den Hut gezogen und winkt uns damit. Das ist der Vater! Aufregung macht sich an Deck breit. Jeder will so schnell wie möglich an Land. Hast du deinen Koffer, Franz? Mutter streicht mir über den Rücken. Wir werden mit der Masse wie Treibholz nach einem Sturm mitgespült. Draußen falle ich Papa in die Arme. Jetzt wird alles gut. Wir sind in Sicherheit und leben in Freiheit. In der heutigen Folge, in der letzten für das Jahr 2023, spreche ich mit Frank Kohn. Das Interview ist diesmal in zwei Folgen unterteilt, da es sonst den zeitlichen Rahmen sprengen würde. In der ersten Folge, also heute, erfahrt ihr etwas über Franks Kindheit in Deutschland, seine Flucht nach Amerika und seine Jugend in einem fremden Land. In Teil 2 geht es dann um seinen Einsatz als Soldat im Zweiten Weltkrieg. Aber erst einmal etwas zu seiner Person. Frank Kohn wurde am 2. August 1925 in Breslau als Franz Kohn geboren. Heute gehört diese Stadt zu Polen. Als Einzelkind wächst Frank wohlbehütet auf. Sein Vater Martin besitzt ein erfolgreiches Sportgeschäft. Noch bevor die Nazis an die Macht kommen, bekommen die Kohns aber den wachsenden Antisemitismus zu spüren. Im Januar 1927 schlägt eine Gruppe von Nazi-Anhängern Franks Onkel Max brutal zusammen. Dieser stirbt später an seinen Verletzungen. Nachdem die Nazis 1933 schließlich an die Macht kommen, macht ihre Politik das Leben für Juden in Deutschland immer schwieriger. Am 1. April 1933 befiehlt die Nazi-Führung einen landesweiten Wirtschaftsboykott gegen jüdische Geschäfte und Unternehmen. Demonstrationen vor dem Laden von Franks Vater schüchtern die Mitarbeiter ein, sodass die Kohns ihr Geschäft verkaufen. Der Vater findet eine neue Stelle in einer Fabrik, die Stoffballen an Bekleidungsgeschäfte und Schneidereien verkauft. 1934 wird Frank eingeschult. Auch dort erlebt er antisemitische Anfeindungen und Diskriminierungen. Auf dem Heimweg wird Frank oft von Hitlerjungen gejagt. Im August 1938 reist Franks Vater in die Vereinigten Staaten, um von dort lebenden Verwandten eine eidesstattliche Erklärung zu bekommen, damit die Familie aus Deutschland ausreisen kann. Kurz nachdem er das Land verlassen hat, sucht die Gestapo ihn zu Hause auf. Ruth, Franks Mutter, soll ihrem Mann mitteilen, dass er sich bei der Ankunft sofort im Hauptquartier der Gestapo melden soll. Diese schickt ihm aber einen Brief, in dem sie ihren Mann vor der Rückreise warnt. Sie selbst kämpft um ein Touristenvisum, um mit ihrem Sohn selbst in die USA reisen zu können. Heimlich packen Mutter und Sohn jeweils einen einzigen Koffer. Frank darf keinem seiner Freunde ein Sterbenswörtchen von ihren Abreiseplänen erzählen. Frank fährt mit seiner Mutter mit dem Schiff von Rotterdam aus nach New York City. Die Familie trifft sich am 30. Oktober 1938 in New York wieder. Die Wiedersehensfreude ist von der Angst getrübt, dass die Amerikaner alle deutschen Staatsbürger zurück in ihre Heimat schicken könnten, so wie es vorab viele Male passiert ist. Am 9. November bricht jedoch eine Welle antijüdischer Gewalt über Nazi-Deutschland herein. Die Reichspogromnacht, oder wie die Nazis sie propagandistisch nennen, die Reichskristallnacht. Daraufhin verlängert Präsident Roosevelt alle Visa der Deutschen, sodass die Kohns bleiben dürfen. Frank muss eine ihm fremde Sprache so schnell wie möglich lernen, um zur Schule gehen zu dürfen. Kurz nach seinem 18. Geburtstag 1943 meldet sich Frank freiwillig, um im Zweiten Weltkrieg zu kämpfen. Er will dem Land, das ihn aufgenommen hat, etwas zurückgeben. Hört jetzt rein in das Interview, damit ihr Franks Erzählungen aus erster Hand erfahren könnt.
Hello, Mr. Kohn.
Hello there.
Hi
How are
there.
You?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
So thank you so much that you took the time today to talk to me.
Fine. So we're going to start.
Yes. Where do you live in the States?
Starting from the beginning.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I was born in Breslau, which of course you probably know is now Wrocław,
yeah.
Poland. But it was Germany in 1925 when I was born. And We lived in Breslau until 1938, when we escaped to the United States. But that's the big story.
Yeah. What major experiences did you have as a child when you grew up in Breslau?
Okay. Well, I was born into a very comfortable middle-class family. And we had, at that time, most of the middle-class people had live-in maids, and we did too. We had a live-in maid. And when I came along, they hired another girl to take care of me. Now, this was all very comfortable. My parents had a sporting goods store, and the store provided them with a fine income, so we could live very comfortably. And then, of course, the 1930s came along, and things became a little hairy. The first thing that had happened was one of my uncles in another city, in Chemnitz. He was accosted by stormtroopers, and they found out he was Jewish, and they killed him. And it was at that point that, now nobody explained things to me, mind you. I was just a young child. But even as a young child, you listen to the adults and you draw your own conclusions. And it was quite obvious that the Nazis were dangerous and that you had to consider them not your friends. And became very obvious to me even as a child. The other thing that happened at that point was when I looked out of the window, diagonally across from us was a finance office. And somehow that finance office always pulled demonstrators. And I was watching when there were fights between the communists and the Nazis in front of the finance office. And that was explained a little bit to me because it was obvious that I saw something and it had to be explained. And the explanation was more or less neither the communists nor the Nazis were going to be our friends. So the word Nazi was in me quite early in life when I was about 5 years old. And then 1933 came along, and by then I'm 8 years old. Well, I was still seven, but I was going to be eight soon. And that's when Hitler came to power. And immediately that affected us because there were Nazi in uniform in front of our business, and they were saying, "Don't buy from Jews." And my father recognized immediately that this was going to be a losing proposition, and he sold the house, his store, as quickly as he could. That was considered a catastrophe at the time, but it really was a lifesaver because the store would have been an anchor and we would not have left at the time that we did leave. And as you'll see, we left just at the right time. Anyway.
Did you have did you have any siblings?
Pardon me?
Did you have any siblings, or did you grow up with a brother or sister?
Oh, no, I was an only child.
Okay.
I was an only child. Spoiled as could be, naturally, as an only child.
And what kind of what kind of store did your parents have?
Well, of course, I started school in 1932, and my first class teacher, he was old. He was at least 50 years old, and I can't remember much about him. But my second grade teacher was a young fella, and I immediately thought he was just great, and I loved him. And when I heard that he was coming back for the third grade, I was all excited about it. And when he came in full Nazi uniform. And I was devastated. Now things turn ugly in a way. The Clash had to sing Nazi songs, and when they were singing Nazi songs, they had to stand up. But me, I was Jewish. I was the only one in class, and I had to sit down because I was not allowed to sing those songs. Well, a kid who's sitting down when everybody gets up is not going to be very popular, obviously.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that the teacher was very correct. He wouldn't allow them to pick on me. However, after school, the word came out to others that I was Jewish, and they started to chase me. And I was a pretty good runner, and I evaded them, and I told my parents. And they said, well, we'll fix that. And they took me out of the public school and put me into a private Jewish school.
Could you just turn back to could you take us with you in the classroom when you were in third grade? What kind of subjects were, like, important?
Well, of course, as the third grade went along, the kids started to bring Hitler Youth items that they were wearing. They had joined the Hitler Youth, and they had belts, and they had shirts, and they had insignias and whatnot, and they brought that into school. But there were a number of other kids who did not join the Hitler Youth, so I wasn't that obvious in that respect. But I certainly was obvious when they sang their Hitler songs.
Yeah.
Now, what happened, of course, is that you started to fold in into the Jewish community, and you had less and less contact with the Germans. And going back again, when Hitler came to power, I had been playing with some German kids in a sandbox at the time, and suddenly they didn't show up anymore. And it became quite obvious that they didn't want to play with me, or that their parents told them that you can't play with him. And that was the end of those liaisons with German kids. And I joined a soccer club where I played soccer. This was a Jewish team, and the Jewish teams only could play against other Jewish teams because you were not allowed to mix. And this was very obvious in 1934 when the laws were passed, which more or less segregated the Jews from the Aryans. And our live-in maid had to be let go because Aryans were not allowed to work for Jews anymore. That live-in maid, she was really a second mother to me. So it was a very dramatic type of thing. But I had soured a little bit on her because in 1934, a year before, Hitler came to Breslau. And Bertha, that was her name, wanted to see Hitler. And of course, she had me in tow. And she instructed me that I had to come along, and that when Hitler came, I had to offer my Hitler salute. I said, I'm not allowed to, I'm a Jew. He said, you just do what I tell you to do, and you do the Hitler salute. Well, I was scared because I thought maybe one of the kids from my public school might see me and report me, and I could be in big trouble. Hitler came and in his convertible, and the people around me went haywire. Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. They were screaming like mad, and so was Bertha. And I couldn't understand why she would love a guy who would hate me. And it was at that time that I had lost some sympathy for Bertha. And when she left, it became manageable, although I was still devastated. Anyway.
How was the experience?
As time went on, yes.
How was the, like, your feelings when you saw Hitler yourself in person? Can you describe the feeling?
Do what?
When you saw Hitler yourself in person, could you describe your feelings? What he looked like or what kind of person he seemed to be when you came to Breslau?
When Hitler came to Breslau? Yeah.
Could you describe him as a person?
Yeah, I can still remember it because it was such a dramatic thing, because I was really scared. I was scared stiff.
Yeah.
Because nobody had seen me, so everything worked out okay. But I never told my parents.
Oh, no.
Never told my parents. They never knew that I was with Bertha.
They wouldn't be happy about that.
Yeah, I really, I was good at keeping a secret, and I never did tell her.
How did things work out with Bertha? After that day, how did things change with her, with Bertha, when she, like, came there and screamed and you just...
Yeah, well, of course, there was a big change when she left. My mother was drawn into the house more. She had to do all the things that Bertha used to do. And of course, supervision then went from Bertha to my mother. So in a sense, it brought the family closer together. And being the only child, there was only one person to supervise, and that was me. Anyway, as time went on, economically, it became more and more difficult for my parents. My father had picked up another business, that is, selling bales of cloth to manufacturers and individuals. But obviously, the only ones he would be able to sell after 1935 were to other Jewish places. And they were disappearing one after another. So his business was disappearing. And he knew he had to do something drastically, because the money was starting to run out. And he had some distant relatives in the States. And he had decided that he was going to try to see if he could find them. And with that, he got himself a visitor's visa. But he waited until my bar mitzvah, which was in August of 1938. So after that, and that was a great affair for me. I got a BMW bicycle. This is regular bicycle, not a motorized one. And that was my first bicycle. And I got lots of other presents. I don't know how many pen and pencil sets I got as a present. And got stamps for my stamp collection, and I was very happy with my position on the soccer team. I was in the forward line, and life was pretty good, except that we couldn't do anything outside. Like, we couldn't go to any restaurants because they had signs, Jews not desired or Jews forbidden or whatever it was. And life was a little bit rough outside, but inside it was great. So my father took off for the United States, and he did find his relatives. But as you probably know, in those days there was a depression.
Yeah.
And what he wanted was an affidavit, which is a document that is necessary for immigration. And that document indicates that the person who issues it has a responsibility that person will never become a burden to the state, which means you have to have some money. And they didn't have that. Now, again, that was like a devastating development. But again, it was a lifesaver, because my father decided to stay longer to see if he could find somebody else who could give him an affidavit. And in the interim, the Gestapo came to our door looking for him. So my mother immediately wrote him not to come back because of that.
Did Do you know the reason why the Gestapo showed up at your house?
Yes, at our door, two Gestapo agents, and they looked exactly what you would consider. They had these boots on and clothing, dark clothing, and a hat and whatnot, in civilian clothing, but they were frightening. Certainly were frightening to me, and they were frightening to my mother. And what they told my mother was, well, she had told them that he was on an international business travel, and she was told immediately that when he comes back, he must report to Gestapo headquarters. And that was a red light, you might say, because my mother and even I knew that we had a business acquaintance by the name of Michaelis, who a few months before had been told to report to Gestapo headquarters, which he did, and they found him a few hours later on the sidewalk. He either had been pushed or jumped out of a third-story window. So that came to mind, to my mother and to me, so we were very frightened about this. And a couple of days later, a British lady came to the door, and she had a document that said that we were obligated to provide her with a bedroom. So she moved in, and we knew, of course, that she was a Gestapo reporter. My mother told me, you can't say anything in the house anymore that could be misinterpreted, so keep your mouth shut in front of her. But but she was being nice to me, and she said, do you know any English? I said, no. She said, well, would you like to have an English lesson? I said, yeah, sure. So she gave me two English lessons. And of course, not knowing that this was going to be of real value later on.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, another thing happened just then, and that was the passports of Jews were had to be brought in to be stamped with a big J. And that was really at the behest of the Swiss government. It wasn't a German initiative. The Swiss wanted to be sure that they knew that the people coming across their border, if they were refugees, the ones with the J would be refugees, and they didn't want to let them in. Anyway, my mother thought, my goodness, the next thing might be the confiscation of the passports. So she went to the American consulate and got herself a visa, a visitor's visa, just like what my father had. And the lucky thing was that they didn't have computers, because had they had computers, they would have known that my father was already in country and that that visa would have been a refugee and not a visitor's visa, and she never would have gotten it. And then completely out of character, she went back and bribed somebody to put me on that visa as well. And that was easy because I was on her passport. Anyway, she told me one fine day then, let's go for a walk. I knew that was, she had some important information. So we went outside and she said, should we go? And I knew what she meant. And this was a rough question for me because I had such a comfortable life in a way, even though outside it was, but it was the smartest thing I ever did in my whole life. I said, let's go, because I knew we weren't wanted in that country.
Yeah, and you had no idea that it
got worse. And kid 13 could have put up a lot of flack and might have dissuaded her from going on this visitor's visa. But I said, let's go, and she said, well, you have to keep your mouth shut. Don't tell anybody about this. And again, I knew I had to keep my mouth shut. And there was one more soccer game to play, and I went and I was distracted and I helped lose the game. And at the end of the game, I said, see you next time. But I knew there wasn't going to be a next time. And I really never heard or saw any of these kids ever again. And I never knew how many of them were killed later on, because it was pretty late in the game.
That must be now, pretty tough when you knew it was your last game, but no one did, and you could not say goodbye to anyone.
No, I couldn't say goodbye to anyone.
Yeah.
And I felt bad about it, but I knew I had to keep my mouth shut. So the next morning at 5 in the morning, my mother was able to make all kinds of arrangements from Breslau to get a first-class passage on Holland America Line, to get 2 weeks of first-class hotel reservations in New York and all that, because what is she going to do with the money? Because all we were allowed to do to take out was one suitcase and 10 marks.
That's nothing.
She and me. And you know how far 10 marks will go if you have an overseas trip there. It was ridiculous. But that, in other words, we were really at the mercy of either relatives or else of the relief organizations in the States. Well, we got on a train to Berlin, where she said goodbye to her father, who ended up in a concentration camp and killed. But of course, she didn't know that at that point. But she knew that she might not ever see him again. And she said goodbye to her oldest sister. And she and her family went to Australia. So she never saw her older sister again either. But that wasn't exactly for sure when we left. Anyway, we got to the border and in a train, and we crossed into Holland. We went first into Amsterdam, where she said goodbye to her cousin, Kurt Josephson. He and his wife and a son at my age had escaped to Holland from Germany, which was a bad place to escape to, because later on they were taken prisoner and they were put in a concentration camp. Now, the miracle was that he and his wife, and his wife was a very meek lady, they survived the concentration camp, but the boy didn't. He was taken in a group with other kids, about 100 kids, placed in a field, and they didn't provide him with any food or additional clothing, and they either died of starvation or of the cold. We never knew what killed the boy, but he didn't survive. Anyway, in Amsterdam, she also went to the banker Rothschild, and that banker wasn't a stopping place for refugees, because he provided them with some funds. So she got some money from them, and it must have been pretty good, because she was very happy when she came back. But I never asked, and I never found out how much money it was, but I'm pretty sure it was a considerable sum. And then we got on the ship, first-class passage, the Staatendamm. That steamer was at the bottom of Rotterdam Harbor when the war broke out. They bombed it. But at this point, I was on a luxury cruise. I was first-class passenger, and I lived it up. I had no worries. Now, my mother had a lot of worries, but she worried when we get there, we go to Ellis Island, and if they find out in Ellis Island that my father is already in country, they put us on the next boat going back to Germany. So she was not happy on that trip, but I was. And I almost became the ping pong champion, but one man beat me, so I didn't get
Forrest that. Gump maybe beat you.
Anyway, now we got to New York Harbor, and I was all excited because my gym teacher had told me about the skyscrapers and the Statue of Liberty and about Horn and Hearted restaurants. Horn and Hearted restaurant was well known at the time, but you probably don't know what it was. But it's a restaurant where you didn't have any contact with any people. It was an automat where you put your money into slots and the little door opens and you took out either a breakfast or a dessert or an entree or whatever it was that you wanted. As long as you had the coins, you could get that. And I was all excited and anticipating to see that. Anyway, sure enough, we saw the skyscraper and I had my box camera. I took a picture. I took a picture of the Statue of Liberty. And I understood what that meant too, because that was explained to me and it was important. And I was very happy about that. And then a very big surprise came to us. And that was first class passengers were invited to go through customs direct onto the dock while everybody else had to go to Ellis Island. So we evaded Ellis Island with that first class passage. Money talks. This is one of the lessons to be learned there. Amazing. Anyway, we had a happy reunion with my father, and then it became not quite so happy because he had real concerns. He was at the mercy of the Jewish relief organizations, and they told him that this support was finite. Eventually, we had to go back, and now we were a whole family. What was going to happen there? Now, the first 2 weeks, of course, we were in good shape because we were in a first-class hotel, and that was already paid for. But what was it would happen later? Well, we had arrived in New York on the 30th of October, 1938. On the 9th of November, just 10 days later, was Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
Now, that, of course, was a great catastrophe, and it was splashed all over the headlines, and we read that, and we were all concerned about our relatives as to what would happen to them, and we had no contact with them, so we didn't know. It was very disturbing.
Was it in the American newspaper as well about the special night on November 9th? Where all the stores were destroyed and the Kristallnacht just
the problem is you speak in a very high voice.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult for me.
Okay.
People with the low voice I can understand well. High voice I got real trouble.
Yeah. I asked if
so if you speak slowly, I think sometimes I can.
About the Kristallnacht, was it in the American newspaper so you could read about it?
Yes.
We
had a German newspaper that my father was able to get.
Okay.
And because his English was pretty negligible, and mine was negligible, and my mother's was negligible. So we leaned on the German German-American paper. And that described it very vividly as to what was happening in Germany. So we understood exactly what was going on. But this catastrophe ended up being a liberation for us because President Roosevelt issued an executive order that indicated that anyone in country would not be sent back to Germany. So we were saved.
Yeah.
Our visitor's visa were now extended indefinitely.
That's great. That was just the right time, the right place.
There we were saved, even though this was such a big catastrophe. So you never know what good can come out even of a terrible catastrophe like that.
Did you experience a personal miracle?
Yeah, it was like a miracle, wasn't it?
Yeah, would you say that was your personal miracle?
The timing, you couldn't have timed it better.
Yeah.
You know, 10 days before Crystal Night. And had we still been there in Crystal Night, we never would have gotten out.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have gotten out because our visas wouldn't have been honored anymore. So there we were, and they immediately enrolled me into junior high school, seventh grade. I left seventh grade. I was still in seventh grade. And of course, it was a little bit difficult at the point because I didn't speak. I had two lessons of English. Thank God for that, but I really didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
The first or second day in class, the teacher told me, take the waste paper basket and go around and collect the trash. And she was looking at the window. And I thought, well, she wants me to open the window. So I opened the window. Of course, everybody's laughing. And the kid doesn't like to be laughed at.
Yeah.
But again, I was, you know, I'd been an outcast in the German public school. I was acceptable in the Jewish private school. I was just another one of the kids. I was as popular as anybody else was, probably more popular because I had a position on the soccer team. Anyway, and here again, I was an outcast because who wants to deal with a kid who can't speak the language, you know? Not that anybody was nasty to me. And as a matter of fact, they were very polite and very forthcoming, trying to be helpful, but I didn't have any friends there. Eventually, another kid from Austria came into that class, and the two of us at least were able to communicate pretty well. But I was on the spot, and I knew I had to learn that English as quickly as possible. Now, the teachers were very helpful. They got magazines with pictures, and they put the name of the item that's displayed and such. So that was helpful for some very basic things. And then I listened to the radio, but the radio was difficult because I couldn't understand the plot. But what I did understand was the intonations. So I didn't have to get that German accent, which I understood immediately. I didn't want a German accent. I wanted to fit in. So the radio helped in that respect. But what really helped me was the movies. Because in the movies, you could see what was going on, and you could hear what was going on, and you could relate and get the words to fit what was happening, and you got better understanding, and it really taught. Now, the problem was movies was 10 cents. Well, now 10 cents is nothing. In those days, 10 cents was a lot. And for us, it was particularly a lot because we had no income. We just lived on what the relief organizations gave. But what had happened, luckily, somebody referred me to Time magazine that ran a movie in front of a regular movie. And so it was a sort of a trailer of news that was provided before the regular movie went on. And they wanted to have a little segment about what happened in Germany. And since they couldn't get into Germany doing that, they staged it in the States and in New York. And they had a classroom and they had a blackboard. And on the blackboard was something like, Jews are our Unglück.
Yeah.
And there were two boys standing next to the blackboard with their heads down. And I was one of those kids. I was there. They put me there. All I had to do was stand there and look sad and put my head down. And I got $100 for that.
Okay.
Well, obviously, they were trying to help some refugee kid.
Yeah.
But that $100 was my ticket for the 10 cents to the movies. I used that, and I exhausted quite a bit of that money going to the movies and learning English. Now, my father had gotten a room sublet from a Greek lady who had an apartment what was it, 137th Street, I think it was, Broadway. And we had this one room, the three of us slept in the room, and we had kitchen privileges, and these Greek people were very nice to us. And we lived there a number of months, really. And I didn't really recognize how primitive this was. Kid like that takes that kind of thing in stride. And we helped with the Greek war relief effort. They had little soldiers with skirts that we that had to be painted, and I helped them paint the skirts red. So this was one thing. Now, they had three kids, one boy my age, a girl a little younger, and another kid, another boy much younger, but they never played with me, except the youngest one. He was willing to play with me. I'm still an outcast, you know, and all that because of the English. Anyway, I did pretty well in school, it was in ninth grade that one little girl, a redhead, I still remember her name, Mary Cavanaugh, she came to me, and I had been very good at math because in Germany, math was much more concentrated, and it was I was way ahead in math. So she came to me and asked me to help her with her math homework. Well, I really lived for that. I was just hilariously happy.
You were flying over.
But I was too shy to ask her to go to a movie with me or something like that. But I really lived it up. She had asked me to help her with math, and I did as much as I could. But my English was getting pretty good at that point. And when I went from junior high school to high school, in high school, I was finally again accepted because my English was well enough that I was not an outcast anymore. So I started to fit in into the American scene. Well, I was in high school. And now another thing happened that I should tell you, and that is after school, and there was a junior high school on our block. We had moved out of that one-room apartment, first of all, into a brownstone that had an apartment half above and half below street level. So that was not the best apartment yet. But in the back was an anthill, a little garden, you might say, that we had access to, and there was an anthill, and I studied that anthill that provided some entertainment for me, aside from the movies. And then we moved into a sort of better apartment. This was not the greatest either. It was a railroad apartment. You go into the living room, had the entrance door, and from the living room, you had to go through the bedrooms and into through the kitchen to get to the bathroom all the way in the back. So there was this continuous walk through, and if you ever had a visitor, well, you better have your beds made because they had to go through the bedrooms, through the kitchen, and the kitchen better be clean to the bathroom. So it was a very awkward arrangement. And we lived there for many, many years. But my father had gotten permission to work, and he became a stock clerk at the Eagle Pencil Company. And my mother did millinery work. She had learned millinery. But of course, when the war started to come, women didn't wear hats anymore. So that went out, and she ended up catering for Temple Emmanuel in New York. And as a caterer, she was paid very nicely. So they were doing comfortably enough. Anyway, I was in high school, and as I indicated to you, after high school, after school, and we had this junior high school right across from me, and I went there after school to play ping pong. And there were two girls and this refugee kid who had joined me in the class in the junior high school. He was in high school with me, so we were pretty good buddies. He lived at 100th Street, and I lived at 108th Street, so it was 8 blocks. He came down, and we went together to play ping pong, and we found two girls. One was called Ping, and the other was called Pong. Now, I like Pong, and wouldn't you know it, of course, I didn't know it at the time, I married Pong.
You did? That's crazy.
I met her there. She was in junior high school, and I was in high school.
That's unbelievable.
Well, anyway, but it wasn't that smooth going, because one fine day, I was in the winter on a Sunday, and some kid came running, and I was outside with some other friends, and one kid came running, the Japs just bombed Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor, what's Pearl Harbor? No idea. Well, finally, we researched it and find out Pearl Harbor was Hawaii, and we recognized this was war, and then a couple of days later, war was declared because Germany declared war on us, and we declared war on Germany. And I was actually very happy about it, because I knew when we went to war, that will be the end of Germany, at least the Nazis. And I was very comfortable about it, but it certainly wasn't affecting me. I was 16 years old. Nobody was going to do anything with me near this war. But it didn't take too long before I recognized, whoops, that war is going to affect me. Well, first of all, people volunteered, and I knew I owed the country something. So here was a possibility of me volunteering to be a messenger for the air raid wardens. And I volunteered with that. And I did very well with that, because I started on as a block messenger, and I became a sector messenger, and then I became a zone messenger working out of the police precinct at 100th Street in New York. And so I was getting very important, and
yeah.
I learned all kinds of things, like how I can shut off the street lamp. I knew how to shut off a street lamp. You know how to shut off a street lamp? No. Well, I did. I knew it. So, but 18th birthday was coming closer and closer, and I knew I was going to be drafted. Now, what I didn't know was that I was an enemy alien. And I didn't know that term at all.
No.
I just thought I was stateless, because my passport was invalidated. My mother's passport. And I didn't have a passport, and I was stateless. But as a enemy alien, I was not allowed to volunteer for the Army. But I could be drafted. But when drafted, I have the option to decline the draft as an enemy alien. Well, all that didn't even get into my mind. I knew I owed the country, and I was all excited to be drafted anyway. So what happened was I was 18 in August, and I was drafted in September. It didn't take long at all. They needed people.
Yeah.
So, and I went to Fort Dix, New Jersey, at the reception center. And what happens in New Jersey in the reception center would be the first day you became oriented and got your uniforms and things like that. The second day you went on KP, and I did, and that they woke you up at 4 in the morning, and you worked till 8 at night. And I knew right away that's something in the army that I wouldn't want to have. And I was pretty successful. I evaded that, and I had KP maybe three times, and that's all in my whole army career. I think that's a good record for somebody who was drafted. Anyway, and the third day you got shots, and you got your orders to go to basic training. Everybody got their orders, but not me. Why didn't I get my order? So I march up to the sergeant, who I knew his name for quite a while, and now it escapes me. Well, you do lose some information as you go along. Anyway, I reported to him, and I said, how come I don't have orders? Let me check. And he came back, and that's when I found out I was an enemy alien. He said, you're an enemy alien, and the FBI has to investigate you. You're going to be here for quite a while. I said, I was thinking of my God, that KP. I see what I can I do. I said, Sergeant, you know, I'm pretty well versed on Army things because I had high school ROTC and I had one term of summer college ROTC, one term of college ROTC. So I know how to do the close order drill. I know the weapons. So I know quite a number of things. He said, I'm glad you told me that because thinking of what I can do with you, you're just going to be sitting here for a month at a time. I'm going to make you an acting gadget. I said, what's an acting gadget? He said, here is your armband. The armband had corporal stripes. He gave me the armband, and here I am after 3 days in the army, an acting corporal. He said, what am I going to do? He said, you know, these new recruits, the ones who came 3 days after me, the new recruits, well, you get them in a formation and you march them to the theater. And in theater, you see two films just like you did just now. And then you wait and then you march them back. And that's going to be your job for the time that you're going to be here. I said, great, I'll do that. And I did. And these two films, the first one was a sort of a propaganda film. It was Why We Fight. It was a very good film explaining why these kids were being drafted in the army and what this war was all about. It was very well done. And the other film was How to Prevent Sexually Transmitted Diseases. Yikes. I have a record of seeing that film more times than anybody else in the army. I was there for 3 months, yeah. And I marched these kids, and it was a graphic film because some of them passed out. It was that graphic. So I knew how to call for an ambulance.
And how to stay safe.
Well, the things you get to do in the army, it's amazing. It never gets boring, I'll tell you that. Anyway, it took 3 months before I got clearance and I got orders to basic training. Now, here again, it was a funny thing because I got into a basic training class because I had had just a little bit of college. And this basic training was for all those kids who had had some college. And they, after basic training, they were going to go back to college to finish, which was a ridiculous thing because to go back to college and to finish, it would have gotten me to 1946, which is the year after the war was over. So, before the basic training was over, somebody else recognized that this was ridiculous because they didn't need college graduates. They needed infantry replacements because by then they had the invasion and they had lots of losses in the invasion. They had to have replacements for infantry. And we had to, so instead of going to college, we went after basic training to the 87th Infantry Division at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Well, that division wasn't the greatest division because it's got a lot of people who were disillusioned. There were a lot of kids who had expected to get college, and here they went to the infantry. Now, I really wasn't that disillusioned because I owed the country, and they could do with me whatever they wanted. They wanted me in infantry, that's fine, I'll be infantry. And then there were kids who were going to be air pilots, and they washed out. They came to the 87th Division. So the morale of that division was pretty low. One incident I can tell you about, they had a general who was going to be asked to see what he could do to engage us and get the morale going. And he would come in and he would say, "How do you feel, men?" And we were rehearsed to say, "Rough, tough, and ready for combat." Well, sure enough, he came, and sure enough, there were people in the front who meekly said, "Rough, tough, and ready for combat." Much louder in the back, "Piss poor and praying." Well, we were restricted for 2 weekends. Now we couldn't leave for anything. So it didn't go over too well. But it explained what the division was all about. But anyway, I had really a good time there to start with, because I had a cousin, and that cousin I had met her when I was a young kid at a farm, a Jewish farm that my parents sent me during the summer. And all these kids got together, and this cousin of mine, who I was in contact with by letter, and when she heard that I was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, she said, "That's Columbia, and South Carolina, and they got a university there, and I got a lot of friends in that university." So I met all these girls in that university, and I took them out one after another.
Luckily, you saw the movie a lot of times. You were prepared.
Riding high. But things happen, and things happen to me. I was on a demonstration team for gas attack. The Germans had used gas, and we weren't going to be surprised. So I had my gas mask on, and the instructor had drawn what he thought was a smoke grenade to make it a little more dramatic. And he threw that smoke grenade, and it ended up not smoke, but white phosphorus, which burns. And luckily, with my gas mask, it only hit me around the ears, and it hit me on the hands, and it hit me on the arms a little bit, and my backpack caught fire, and I got rid of that, and I was dashing to the dispensary, and they didn't know what to do with me until the instructor came in, and he had that blast all in his face because he didn't wear a gas mask. So, but he recognized what it was. He said that was white phosphorus. So they got buckets, and they treated him first, of course. He was real bad shape, but they got a bucket for me to put my hands in because the water suppresses the burns, and they applied compresses to my ears, and I was in a hospital for 1 month.
Oh, wow.
To recuperate. Yeah, it was bad.
A long time.
Anyway, during the time in the hospital, the troops went from 5 mile march to 25 miles marches with full field pack. So when I came back, they were at 25 miles, and about 15 miles, that was the end of me. They had to take me back with a Jeep. So I wasn't the best soldier anymore in the 87th Infantry Division. So when they were assessed, infantry replacements to get out of the division to go immediately to fill the voyage that happened because of the invasion, I was among those selected to move out of the division. And again, these things, you think you're being picked on or something. It was a lucky thing for me that they did that. And I'll tell you why. I'm now an infantry replacement. I go to the port, to England, and then from England to France, and from France to Belgium. And you would think that they need the replacements badly, that this would go fast, but it didn't go fast. We were in England for at least 3 weeks, and then across to France, and it took a while in France. We were on these, just like in the concentration camps, these were boxcars, but we weren't shoved in like sardines. We had enough room to lie down, and it was not comfortable, but was comfortable enough. And then it went all the way up to Belgium, and I was in Belgium. Figured out that I spoke German.
What time are you talking about? Like late 44 or?
This is now, the invasion was in 1944 in June, and all this training and whatnot, it was November of 44 that I was in Belgium up there, and they finally took me back to the Western Navy of Paris for a 2-week course. Now, I don't know if you ever heard of the Ritchie Boys.
Yes.
These were refugees like me, probably not enemy alien. They were probably at regular immigration. And they had an 8-week course of how to become an intelligence agent. And here I went back to the VSMA, and they had extracted some of the subjects that they were teaching the Ritchie Boys, and they had a 2-week course for us to learn and become an intelligence agent. And after 1 week, they needed me so badly, they took me out. So I was only trained for 1 week, and I became a full-fledged intelligence agent. Coming out of that class, I was placed into a six-man interrogator prisoner of war team number 66 that was attached to T Force, which was task force to be under 12th Army Group, which is General Bradley, the one right under General Eisenhower. Bradley and Montgomery were the two generals under him, and this T Force was right under Bradley. So we were going to work in the first and third Army areas when we were deployed in operational missions. And the operational mission was either building or personality targets. The building targets were anything that would be of use to the force, such as an installation or a government headquarters or Nazi Party headquarters, or a utility like the electricity and what and telephone, whatnot.
Street
so
lamp.
So anything that was of use to the force, we had a dossier.
Yeah, the street lamp.
And, yeah. And then the personality targets were those people who were going to be tried for war crimes. And of course, the building targets also would provide information in support of prosecution of war criminals, like these Nazi headquarters and such, Gestapo headquarters, so dossiers. Well, I got back to Belgium in around the 1st of December of 1944, and we had married up with T-Force, so we were a larger unit by then. With our six-man team, there was two officers, two interpreters, and one is a staff sergeant, and the fellow was named Fröhlich, and we called him Flo. And the nickname Flo, you understand the nickname. Usually the others don't. And we had a NCOIC, non-commissioned officer in charge, and a driver. Well, the two officers and the two enlisted, the staff sergeant and me, the PFC, we don't wear our rank. We wear USUS. So nobody knew what my rank was. The NCOIC was a tech sergeant. He wore his rank. And the driver was a technician of fifth class. So he had this little one stripe. Well, it was more like a corporal. So the driver really outranked me, but he didn't know that because I had USUS and I always bossed him around when we had to go together someplace. And that was quite often. But he didn't know that he really outranked me. Anyway, we were there 16 December, the Battle of the Bulge starts. And that was a frightening thing. Not so much because anybody was shooting at us, but all the rumors were floating around. And now I was told to go with my rifle, and it got dark, into a access road with the instruction, don't let any Germans come in. Not very much training there. So I'm with a rifle, I have a flashlight, and the first vehicle that come, I stop it. The guy says, what the heck are you doing? I said, I'm making sure you're not a German. And if I was a German, you'd be dead by now. You get your tail and get into the ditch there and do things from the ditch. So I think you got a good point. I went into the ditch. The next vehicle comes, I'm yelling, halt, halt, halt. They don't hear me, they go right through. I'm not doing my job. And then I didn't know what to do. Back and forth from the ditch to the road and whatnot. I was in the ditch and I see a vehicle. And then at the last minute, I jump up and try to stop them. And, you know, and it's scary. They bring news about paratroopers, German paratroopers coming in. And shooting is all around the area. You can hear it. And not that there was anybody to shoot at that point from where we were, but who knew what was what. So it was just nerve-wracking. You just scared the heck out of me. Anyway, about midnight, we got called in and we have a midnight move towards Antwerp. What we didn't know was that Antwerp really was the target of the Bulge. They were trying to catch Antwerp, which was a port, and we had started to use that port, and that was the idea of the Bulge to get into Antwerp. Well, we didn't get to Antwerp either, neither did they. So we got up to Namur, and there we got orders to look for Germans in American uniforms who had penetrated our lines, and we were to look for them. And we went all through Belgium on the road nets, Namur, Dinan, Rochefort, Sinet, Remouchon. I still remember all those names. Yeah.
How did you manage to find those Americans?
Well, like the big Germans? Problem was the weather. The weather was, if you say the Battle of the Bulge, the first thing that hits my mind is snow. It was cold, and we had to make these routes with our windshield down because you can't shoot through a windshield.
Yeah.
And that blast, even at 25 miles per hour, it was just brutal. Now, again, luckily, I was a PFC. That means I was in the back seat, and I got behind the captain, and the captain shielded me to some degree, which I certainly never told him that he did. But that was helpful, but still, it was still misery. It was either snowing or freezing rain or sleet. When the feet got wet, they never got dry.
Yeah.
And you were cold. And it was just miserable.
How did you find those Germans, like, now, wearing U.S. uniforms?
We never intercepted one ourselves, but we got to a roadblock for the infantry. And in front of them, they had found one, and they had wiped it out with a bazooka. So we went and we searched the bodies of the four Germans, and all we found was dog tags. Now we took the dog tags and turned them in, because these are either killed or prisoners. But that was all the information we got out of them. And we never did find out how they knew for sure to wipe that Jeep out. But maybe they didn't know the password or whatever it was. And maybe they had a happy accent when they answered.
Okay.
Anyway,
what kind of passwords did you use? Do you remember?
I mean,
what kind of passwords did you use to, like?
Well, the passwords were changed every day, really. And you would say one thing and you had to reply with something else.
Do you remember what?
Not really.
Like Marco Polo or something?
I don't remember what they were. Could be anything.
Yeah, but something just American.
Like doorknob or.
Yeah.
My goodness, I can't think of anything that was used.
Just something like Americans knew and the Germans don't.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if it was a some sort of term that was used by people of Americans, an American slang word, for example, that might be one of those passwords.
Or some candy, some American candy you don't know in Germany.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway, we were miserable for 7 days, and then finally the weather cleared and the sun came, and as the sun came, our planes started to fly over, and we cheered them because they didn't hear us, but they should have. We really cheered them because we knew that was going to be the turning point for the Battle of the Bulge, and it certainly was, because that stopped the forward movement. And then slowly, slowly, they were beaten back. But we were just put into a holding area, waiting to go into Germany. We had no mission after that. We were able to go to Liège. And the big deal in Liège was a shower, a warm shower. To get that warm shower, the first one, I stayed in that shower 20 minutes and people were screaming to get me out of there, but I wouldn't move. Now, to this day, I take a bath, not even a shower, but I always take a bath every day that I can, because that's the thing that I never got while in the army in those days. So the bathtub is the most important thing in my house.
Can you describe your feelings when you, like...
Things that get carried over, you know?
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, I had a lot of conversations by letter with a lot of people back in the States, but did I write to Pong? No, I never wrote to Pong.
Poor Pong.
What a headache that was later on. But at that time, I just never wrote to Pong. Well... finally, we went, started to go into Germany. The first target city was Cologne. And I remember going towards Cologne, you could see the cathedral in the distance that was still in good shape. Well, when we finally got into it, it had been hit and damaged, but it was still standing. But everything around the cathedral was flat. It was all flattened out. It was a miracle that that church was still standing in the middle of Cologne. Now, after Cologne, we went to Düsseldorf, then I went to Siegen, then to Frankfurt, then to Wiesbaden, and then to Kassel, and then to Magdeburg, where we met the Russians.
Okay.
Now, at every city, there's a story to be told, but I think we've run out of time here. At least I've run out of time. So if you want to have another session to find out what I did in all these cities, we can do that.
Yes, for sure. That would be great.
Okay. So let me stop where we are now.
Yes, I remember that your step to
it's
Germany.
It's been a little bit over an hour.
Yes.
And I'm getting worn out.
Yes, for sure. So if you have time, we can resume.
Sure. I'll take time to tell you about all these things.
And what happened to Pong after the war? I'm really excited to hear.
Remind me to start after the Bulge.
Okay.
I might give you one more story about the Bulge at that time. it's a funny one, but believe me, we were not laughing at the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, then.
So we'll conclude it now. Yeah.
Yeah, we just text per email and reschedule, make another date.
Okay, good.
Sounds great.
And remember, when you see me again, speak slowly because I can't.
And try to do a dark voice.
Very good.
Do you still speak German?
Ja, ich kann noch sprechen, aber die Wörter kommen nicht in den Sinn. Ich habe keine Gelegenheit, Deutsch zu sprechen.
Ja.
Das schon vor vielen, vielen Jahren habe ich nicht eine Unterhaltung. So, was ich Ihnen erzählt habe, das könnte ich gar nicht in Deutsch machen.
Okay, aber ein bisschen Smalltalk geht in Deutsch.
Das würde zu schwer sein.
Ja. Okay, dann. Bis zum nächsten Mal.
Okay.
See you next time.
Bye bye.
Yeah.
It was nice, very nice meeting you.
Yeah, very nice meeting you.
Very pleasant person.
Yeah.
So thank you.
So talk to you soon.
Bye bye.
Bye.
History Wissen. Heute geht es um die Aufnahme jüdischer Flüchtlinge vor und während des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Die Zahl der Flüchtlinge steigt von Tag zu Tag. Viele Staaten haben ihre Grenzen geschlossen. Es kommt zu regelrechten Einreisestopps und Zurückweisungen. Vor den ausländischen Botschaften und Konsulaten bilden sich lange Schlangen. Menschen hoffen auf die begehrten Visa. Aufgrund rigoroser Bestimmungen warten indes fast alle vergebens auf rettende, gültige Ausreisepapiere. Das klingt wie Nachrichten aus der gegenwärtigen globalen Flüchtlingskrise. Es handelt sich jedoch um historische Momentaufnahmen aus dem Jahr 1938. Die von den Nationalsozialisten verfolgten jüdischen Deutschen und Österreicher, kein Land wollte sie aufnehmen. Yvian Le Bain, Juli 1938. In die gediegene Stille des Kurortes am Südufer des Genfer Sees bricht die Hektik internationaler Diplomatie. Beobachtet von mehr als 200 akkreditierten Journalisten kommen hier Vertreter aus 32 Nationen, dazu Abgesandte von 39 Organisationen und Hilfskomitees zusammen, um nach einer Lösung für das jüdische Flüchtlingsproblem zu suchen. Darunter sind unter anderem die USA, Großbritannien, Frankreich, die Niederlande, Australien, die Schweiz, Mexiko und mehrere lateinamerikanische Länder. Noch ist der Krieg fern, doch die Zeit drängt. Im März 1938 wurde Österreich dem Deutschen Reich angeschlossen. Die Lage der 700.000 deutschen und österreichischen Juden hat sich schlagartig dramatisch verschlechtert. Aus nahezu allen Berufen sind Juden mittlerweile gedrängt und durch die schrittweise Entrechtung ihrer materiellen Basis beraubt worden. Tausende haben Nazi-Deutschland bereits verlassen und täglich drängen mehr und mehr zur Auswanderung. Dabei verschärft gerade ein Staat nach dem anderen seine Einreisebestimmungen. Die meisten Regierungsvertreter bekunden zwar Mitgefühl für die jüdischen Flüchtlinge, sie weigern sich jedoch, mehr Menschen aufzunehmen. Sie meinen bereits, genug Flüchtlinge ins Land gelassen zu haben und befürchten, dass es sonst zu Spannungen zwischen Neuankömmlingen und der Bevölkerung geben könnte. Haiti und die Dominikanische Republik sind die einzigen, die bereit sind, Zehntausende von Flüchtlingen aufzunehmen. Aber die Vereinigten Staaten werden das Angebot Haitis nicht zulassen. Die USA spürten immer noch die Folgen der großen Depression aufgrund der Weltwirtschaftskrise. Daher bleibt es beim festgeschriebenen Kontingent von jährlich 27.370 Emigranten aus Deutschland und Österreich. Großbritannien ist kein Einwanderungsland, sagt der britische Vertreter bei der Konferenz. Unerwähnt lässt er das Mandatsgebiet Palästina, in den 30er Jahren Ziel und Sehnsuchtshafen vieler jüdischer Auswanderer. Doch angesichts der Konflikte dort wollen die Briten es sich mit den Arabern nicht verderben. Auch kann keine der zahlreichen Kolonien des Empire Flüchtlinge aufnehmen. Derweil jammern die Franzosen, dass Frankreich schon mit beherbergten Fremden jenseits der Kapazitätsgrenze seien. Also bleibt die Konferenz für die jüdischen Flüchtlinge ohne Ergebnis. Jubeln können allein die Nazis, und das tun sie auch überschwänglich. Niemand will sie haben, so kommentiert das NSDAP-Sprachrohr der Völkische Beobachter. So schreiben sie, vor einem Zustrom jüdischer Einwanderer wollen sie sich schützen, weil man die Nachteile einer Verjudung klar erkannt hat. Fast wie ein höhnisches Echo klingt auch der Satz, den 1939 ein hochrangiger kanadischer Einwanderungsbeamter zur Aufnahme von Juden in Kanada äußert. Er sagt, none is too many. Übersetzt so viel wie, keiner ist schon zu viel. Ein tragisches Ergebnis der auf der Konferenz festgelegten Flüchtlingszahlen ist die bekannte Irrfahrt der St. Louis. Im Mai 1939 versuchen gut 900 jüdische Mitbürger, Deutschland von Hamburg aus zu verlassen. Sie haben ein Schiff, den Dampfer St. Louis. Ihr Ziel? Havanna auf Kuba. Dort wollen sie abwarten, bis sie ein Visum für die USA bekommen. Für die Passagiere ist es die letzte Gelegenheit, dem Terror der Nationalsozialisten zu entkommen. Das Schiff läuft am 13. Mai 1939 in Hamburg unter Kapitän Gustav Schröder aus und hat Kuba als Ziel. An Bord befinden sich 937 zumeist jüdische Flüchtlinge. Jedoch wird ihnen bei der Ankunft in Kuba die Einreise verwehrt. Lediglich 29 Personen, darunter 22 jüdische Flüchtlinge, dürfen das Schiff überhaupt verlassen. Alle anderen müssen auf der St. Louis erneut in See stechen. Auch der verzweifelte Versuch, in den USA Unterstützung zu erlangen und anlegen zu dürfen, schlägt fehl. Die ganze Besatzung muss nach Europa zurückkehren. Um die Gefahren wissend, weigert sich Gustav Schröder, die Betroffenen erneut nach Deutschland auszuliefern. Nach einigen Anstrengungen gelingt es dem Kapitän, seine Passagiere in Belgien an Land zu bringen, von wo aus sie auf Großbritannien, Frankreich, Holland und Belgien verteilt werden. Die vermeintliche Rettung erweist sich aber als Trugschluss. Nach Einmarsch der deutschen Truppen geraten die ehemaligen Passagiere der St. Louis erneut unter den Einflussbereich der Nationalsozialisten. Forschern zufolge wird ein Viertel von ihnen im Holocaust ermordet. Die St. Louis kehrt unter Gustav Schröder 1940 nach Hamburg zurück und der couragierte Kapitän wird an den Schreibtisch versetzt. 2 Jahre vor seinem Tod erhält er 1957 das Bundesverdienstkreuz am Band und wird vom Staat Israel zu einem Gerechten unter den Völkern ernannt. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass mir Frank Cohn seine Geschichte erzählt hat. Oft wird vergessen, wie schwierig es für jüdische Menschen war, ein Visa zu erhalten, um aus Deutschland fliehen zu können. So wurde beispielsweise auch Otto Frank, dem Vater von Anne Frank, ein rettendes Visa verwehrt. Nach dem Krieg schloss Frank seinen Bachelorabschluss in Psychologie und Bildung am City College of New York ab und erhält später einen Masterabschluss in Police Administration von der Michigan State University. Frank diente weiterhin 35 Jahre im Militär und erreichte den Rang eines Oberst, bevor er sich von seiner Rolle als Stabschef des Militärbezirks von Washington zurückzog. Er heiratet 1948 Pauline, geborene Brimberg, und sie haben eine Tochter, Laura. Pauline starb 2021 nach 72 Jahren glücklicher Ehe. Frank ist Freiwilliger im United States Holocaust Memorial Museum und erzählt interessierten Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörern regelmäßig seine Geschichte. Vor allem besucht er auch Schulen, um junge Menschen für diese Zeit zu sensibilisieren. Wenn auch du dir Franks Geschichte angehört hast, dann gehörst auch du zu den Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass die Vergangenheit nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Somit trägst auch du einen Teil der Flamme weiter. In der nächsten Folge geht es wieder um Frank Cohn und um seine Erlebnisse in Europa während und nach Ende des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Ich wünsche euch allen einen guten Rutsch ins neue Jahr. Und möchte mich noch einmal herzlich bei euch allen fürs Einschalten, Anhören und Weiterempfehlen bedanken. Gerne könnt ihr mir eine positive Bewertung dalassen. Im kommenden Jahr könnt ihr euch wieder auf neue interessante Interviewgäste und History-Wissen-Folgen freuen. Alles Liebe und bis zum nächsten Jahr.